already started. Good morning to everyone. And I know that others have traveled this morning, others yesterday from far and near. We want to appreciate that all of you are here so that we can be able to start with our meeting. I'm just trying to go through the documentation that we have. In the meantime, while all of us are also making sure that we do have all the necessary presentations, we've got a very small venue, it might make it very difficult for us to have a free movement. And therefore, if we try to have the documentation that will require all of us, and we are ready with everything else, it's going to be easy for us to then facilitate the meeting. It's a tight program. Even before I go to it, I would like to indicate that our expectation as a committee today, we are expecting the Public Service Commission. We are again expecting the Department of Public Service and Administration. We are expecting the Department of Housing as well, Housing Human Settlement, yes. And therefore, those are part of the people who constitute this meeting. And I will indicate why we had all. As the committee, we did go through the report of the Public Service Commission, and part of what we have noticed is that there are issues. Oh, of course, there's also another department that we invited. I'm not very sure if it's there, the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation, which you also expect. just to explain what I was trying to say is that we want to ensure from now onwards, we are going to ensure that once there are reports that had been brought before the committee, brought before Parliament, we have gone through the reports as the portfolio committee, we would then make sure that every time when we request the Public Service Commission to come and present the report, all people involved in those reports will be there to either respond or we agree on a process how do we deal on matters that come, so that we don't have reports. And another later date, it's only then that we deal with the oversight on the report that had been presented. And we think in this way it will be much easier for our work as a committee. That is why then we will have a human settlement, we'll have monitoring and evaluation, we have the Department of Public Safety and Administration. It will be very tight because we have taken four of the reports. It's a sign of showing that we are so packed with the program as a committee for this year, and therefore most of our programs for the day will be so this tight, and therefore there will be no time where we are having free spacing in terms of our committee work. And I also thank everyone who managed to attend the meeting as per request. I would also make it possible for us to do the introductions so that we know who is actually here and who goes with what, so that even when we discuss, it makes it much easier for our discussion. I will do the introduction of the committee members, and then I will request then the Public Service Commission immediately to do their introduction, and thereafter I will request the Department of Public Safety and Administration to also do so, and will request a human settlement to do an introduction. If monitoring and evaluation is there, I didn't get an indication, they will also do that. But safe to indicate that they were really invited late, it might have been difficult for them to make it for the meeting. Okay. All right. From the members, on my left, I've got Honorable Malulege, I've got Honorable Mohali, I am Honorable Muloi Morupa, and I have Honorable Suka, Honorable Williams, Honorable Van Skalkwyk, and lastly, there is Honorable Nyakembe. Can I then request the Public Service Commission to proceed?
Thank you, Chairperson and Honorable Members of Parliament. My name is Ben Mtembu. I'm a commissioner. With me on my left hand, we are having Commissioner Hennessy. And then next to Commissioner Hennessy, we are having Commissioner Mawasha. And then we are also being accompanied by officials. Firstly, we have Andre Naidu, who is the director, who is the Deputy Director General for Monetary and Evaluation Branch. Naidu? Thank you. And then next to him is Dr. Mampisana, who is a Deputy Director General for the Integrity and Anti-Corruption Branch. And then lastly, we are having Mr. Kobas van der Merwe, who is the Chief Director for Monitoring and Evaluation Branch. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Public Citizen Administration, can I request him to do the introduction?
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, Honourable Members. Firstly, apologies from both Prime Minister, Deputy Minister. Both of them are abroad at the moment. And the DG from the department is off ill at the moment, and therefore I'm acting standing in. Honourable Members, accompanying me today, we have the team from DPSA, largely the branch that's responsible for monitoring and evaluation and responsible for anti-corruption. It's the acting DDG, Lynette Singh, as well as Heng Sarfantain and Pitumaling. Will be, Madam Chair, my understanding today, the responsibility of DPSA will be to listen and respond to any issues that may arise and take notes.
Thank you. I know that there is Philip Chauke, who is the Chief Director for Human Settlement. Can I request you to introduce the delegation as well?
Chairperson, thank you. Good morning. Good morning, Honourable Members. My name is Philip Chauke. I'm Chief Director for Monitoring and Evaluation at the Department of Human Settlement. I'm accompanied by Mr. Milile Krawa, who is our Parliamentary Liaison Officer. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, because that was a quick response as well from your side. You got a very short notice. We really appreciate that as well. Okay. Any delegation that is not introduced, just to indicate that for monitoring and evaluation, the invitation could not reach them, and therefore, I'm sure if they haven't made it for this meeting, we shouldn't mind at this point in time. Can we... Maybe before we proceed, let me just indicate the apologies that reached us from our side, the committee members. Honorable Dre is attending the Ethics Committee meeting, and we know it's a session that takes the whole day for today, and we've got so many critical issues. Yes, there was, like indicated by Acting DG, an apology from Honorable Valoi, and the apology from the Minister of Human Settlements also reached us because they also had a commitment with another committee, with the Portfolio Committee for Human Settlement, actually. And then we had also the apology from Honorable Jojo, Deputy Minister, and then, of course, other apologies with the Portfolio Committee Chair, who's also involved in the Portfolio Committee Chairing, is Honorable Dambuza, who is the Chairperson for Human Settlement, is also engaged in the same meeting with the Minister for Human Settlement. And then, yes, I think that this is all what we have at this point in time. Yes, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, just to take you briefly into the agenda, there are some reports that had been tabled, as I indicated earlier on, and now on our agenda we're going to have the briefing by the Public Service Commission on reports tabled in Parliament, and those reports are as follows. It's a report in the Public Service Commission on the overview of the implementation of the financial disclosure framework. That is financial year 2008 to 9 to June 2010. Report on the Public Service Commission on the Consolidated Monitoring and Evaluation Report of the Department of Housing, that is Human Settlement. Evaluation cycle for 2009 to 10 to July 2010. Those are the reports that we're going to start with. There is also a profiling and analysis of the most common manifestation of corruption and its related risk in the public service. The last report there, because it's the three that I've outlined, the last, which is the fourth one, 7 consolidated public service monitoring and evaluation report. So the evaluation cycle is 2009 to 2010. Honourable members and ladies and gentlemen, if the Public Service Commission is ready with the first report, can I get a reflection? They are going to be highly engaged because all these reports, as they have sent them, they are going to present them. And we know that they had two that they had to present. There was an addition of another two. And therefore, I want to believe they were able to spread out time in such a way that you can be able to capture those. A rather short report had been read. Members know about the report. But that presentation then would bring everybody on board so that we can be able to take up issues. We will take issues report by report. We are not going to allow them to do all the 4 reports, but they will do the first report and then we'll engage and so on and so on. And I hope we'll make it with our time as well. Honorable Mtembu, I would like to hand it over to you and your delegation.
Thank you very much.
My apologies. Commissioner Mtembu used to be a member of Parliament. You see, so that thing, you see, that's why. But all right, that's Commissioner Mtembu from the Public Service Commission.
Thank you, Chairperson, honourable members of Parliament. As you are aware, that one of the key functions of the Public Service Commission is the promotion of a high standard of professional ethics. Now, this is one of the 9 democratic principles and values which are set out in Section 195 of the Constitution. Now, it is also important to emphasize the fact that that section stated very clear, that is to say that these 9 principles actually are compulsory. It is stated very clearly that the public administration in the Republic of South Africa shall be underpinned and by these principles. So the issue of these principles is compulsory. It's obligatory. Now, for the Public Service Commission to fulfill its constitutional obligation, it has then developed a financial disclosure framework for senior managers. In terms of this framework, all senior managers, that is from the director up to and including the head of department, it's obligatory that they have to disclose all their financial interests annually with their executive authority. And who then in turn will submit these disclosures to the Public Service Commission not later than the 31st of May of each year. And then the Public Service Commissioner has a responsibility to scrutinize and to check whether is there any senior member who is having some financial interest that may compromise his responsibility as a public servant. In other words, whether is there any conflict of interest. And if there is such, then it has to bring it to the attention of the executive authority, who in turn has to take disciplinary measures. So that is the role of the Public Service Commission. And therefore, the Public Service Commission decided, or took a decision rather, that it's going to make use of the information that it has at its disposal to assess the extent to which senior managers are actually complying with these provisions, which are stated very clearly in the SMS handbook. In other words, we embark on a project to assess the implementation of the disclosure framework, the financial disclosure framework. Because we believe that effective implementation of this framework has got a great potential of reducing, corruption in the public service. It has got a great potential of promoting professional ethics in public service. And we say effective implementation, meaning that 100% compliance, because the Constitution says must, it is obligatory. So there's no question of a discretion. We expect all senior managers, for that matter, because they're at a strategic management level, and they should lead by example. So, Honorable Chairperson, members of Parliament, we have conducted this research or study, and we are going to share with you, one of our key findings as well as implementation. It is our hope as a Public Service Commission that the findings that we present to you, as well as the recommendations, we believe very strongly that if these implementations, after carefully consideration and engagement with us, if they are implemented, it is our hope that they've got a great potential of ensuring that we improve, ethical behavior in our public service, because we owe it to our people. On that note, Chairperson, I will now request Dr. Mampisana, who is the Deputy Director General for Integrity and Anti-Corruption, to make a presentation.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee and Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee, Commissioners, and colleagues from the Department present. As the Commissioner has indicated, we are going to introduce the report that we conducted on the implementation of the financial disclosure framework for the financial year 2008-2009. That simply means we have another one that we have completed, which is 09-10, and we are finalizing the 10-11-1. The outline of the presentation is the following. There will be introduction, submission of the financial disclosures to the PSC, the scrutiny, identification of potential conflicts of interest, scrutiny of the disclosures of heads of department, recommendations, and conclusions thereof. I think Public Service Commission has since 1999-2000 financial year been responsible for the management of the financial disclosure framework for senior managers in the public service. The financial disclosure framework was initially only applicable to heads of department, but since 2000 and 2001, it has been applicable to all senior managers in the public service. The objective of the financial disclosure framework is to manage the potential conflicts that may exist between a senior manager's private interests and public responsibilities in order to ensure that actual conflicts of interest do not occur. The PSC has, since the inception of the framework, placed major focus on ensuring compliance with the submission of financial disclosures, which is a regulatory framework in terms of Chapter 3 of the Public Service Regulations. All members of the senior management services should submit their disclosure forms by 30th April to their executive authorities. And then the executive authorities should therefore submit copies of such forms to the PSC by the 31st of May. And I think we should emphasize this part that by the 31st of May. And then I think this will help us as we understand this presentation as to what is the state of compliance thereof. The submission of financial disclosure forms to PSC, the rate of compliance over the last five financial years is shown in the table as we have. You'll see that from 05-06 financial year, we started from 80 and then move on to 88, which is in the one that is 09-2010. And this report hasn't been tabled here. So you will see that pretty much we are lingering around the 80% mark. That simply means there hasn't been that 100% compliance rate. And I think that's why that statement that says the PSC is of the view that only 100% compliance rate will be acceptable. And the responsibility of ensuring that disclosures are submitted to the PSC timely rests with the executive authorities. I think with the executive authority in the sense that once the officials or senior managers of that particular department have submitted by the end of April, therefore the EA will have them submitted to the PSC by the 31st of May. And to ensure that they are indeed all of them submitted is to say within that month of the officials submitting them to the EA and the EA submitting the PSC, the EAs would have made sure that indeed every official responsible has submitted to them before they are submitted to the PSC. Since the implementation of the financial disclosure framework, the PSC has constantly reminded EAs to submit the outstanding financial disclosures of the senior managers and advise them to institute disciplinary measures against defaulting senior managers. Reminders were also on several occasions forwarded to EAs by the Minister of Public Service Administration at the request of the Public Service Commission. And despite such reminders, a 100% compliance rate has not yet been achieved, and there's been no evidence of senior managers being charged with misconduct for failing to comply with the framework. By the due date of the 31st May 2009, the disclosure forms of 49% FMS members, that is 89% from national departments and 58% from provincial departments were received. And this is reflected in the table below so that you can see again the state of compliance per provinces. And I think you'll see in terms of national departments, in total, we've got 4,588 senior managers. And those who have submitted their forms and that were received by the Public Service Commission for that particular financial year were 1,805. And that leaves us with 2,783 outstanding. And I think this table talks to these figures, which I'm sure it might not be necessary for one to go through them. But I think the picture that is showing is the state of lack of compliance, particularly with the senior managers. And what will therefore mean to members of the portfolio committee in terms of this is that the EAs perhaps are not hands-on here to begin to really say to their heads of department, where are these forms, when are we going to say as a department we have fully complied. Because I think what is also showing to all of us here is that no single province would have said we have outdone ourselves or we have succeeded in complying in this regard. And I think that's what I was saying, at the average rate of the country was at 49%. The scrutiny of financial disclosure forms. Apart from compliance monitoring, the PSC has intensified its efforts to scrutiny of the financial disclosure forms in order to identify potential conflicts of interest. For this purpose, the PSC scrutinized the financial disclosure forms of 30% of all senior managers that submitted their disclosure forms within a given financial year by due date of 31st May. What this means is that when we have our cut point, which is 31 of May, we will scrutinize 30% of only those forms that were received. So in other words, if for a given period within a particular time frame, we haven't had those that will constitute 30%, we'll only scrutinize those that will be within a particular percent that we'll have. And for this particular financial year, as we do every year because we sample provinces for management purposes, the sample of this particular financial year included Northern Cape, Gauteng and the Free State provincial departments, as well as 10 national departments, and those departments are the following: cooperative governance in traditional affairs, education, both basic and higher education training, human settlements, home affairs, labor, national treasury, even ourselves, public office of the Public Service Commission, public administration, leadership and management academy, popularly known as PALAMA, the presidency, state security, sports and recreation, and statistics South Africa. In scrutinizing the disclosures of the sample of senior managers, the PSG assessed whether private interests declared by senior managers could pose a potential threat within their official responsibilities. This was done by assessing whether there is a link between the official duties of a senior manager and the business activities of a company or consultancy which the senior manager holds a directorship or partnership, whether a senior manager is involved in three or more companies, in which instance he or she would not, in all probability, have time to devote his or her full attention to his or her official responsibilities, and whether two or more officials from the same department are involved in the same company or companies, as such officials could make decisions on the awarding of contracts that favor one another. The PSC was concerned that those senior managers that submitted their financial disclosures may not have disclosed all their registrable financial interests. In order to verify information on the financial disclosures, the PSC therefore obtained information on the directorships and partnerships held by senior managers from companies and intellectual property commissions, that's CIPS, I think the formerly known FCPRO, as we knew, based at the DTR, the database, and on the properties owned from the deeds register. The following figures reflect the number of potential conflicts of interest identified to the department and province based on the PSC's assessment of the sample. I think what we are seeing here is the identification of potential conflict of interest, and I'm sure the colors are pretty much clear, and we'll see that in the Office of the Public Service Commission, we had, I think that's the 15% in the education, I think, in terms of the colors. I hope many of us, in terms of the copies that we have, we're having copies that are showing the colors for understanding and clarity purposes. We will give you the original copies that PSC produced that have such information in the colors. I think that will help in terms of page 10. Page 10. I think that would be helpful to really see in terms of. In terms of colors, I know colors, I'm a bit colorblind, but the pink, which is a big one, which is 162 in terms of the identification of conflicts of interest, I think that shows that it's in Gauteng. In terms of the biscuit, which color is the brown?
Okay, I think there is a member who needs clarity because we talk 172 and it's written 207.
In the book.
In the book. So is there a correlation with what is in the book and what is on the presentation?
Yes, because I think what is more, I think there might have been figures that might have jumped around in terms of the table, but I think the one that is key is the one that's in the book.
Okay.
Yes, I think let's use the one that is in there.
Oh, wonderful.
Because that's an approved
proceed,
document.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Identification of potential conflicts of interest. As I indicated in the previous figure, out of the 2,628 financial disclosure forms scrutinized, the PSC identified 542 senior managers that may have potential conflict of interest between their private interests and their official duties. This total represents 20% of all senior managers that form the part of the sample. And I think you will understand the sample from 10 departments in the three provinces. The highest number of potential conflict of interest at provincial level were identified in the Gauteng province, while the highest number in the national departments was identified at the national treasury. The fact that 20% of all senior managers that formed part of the sample may experience potential conflict of interest illustrates the importance of a system such as financial disclosure framework as a mechanism to prevent corruption. Through the identification of the potential conflicts of interest, departments are able to manage the risks associated with the conflicts of interest and ensure that it does not become an actual conflict of interest. The different categories of potential conflicts of interest that senior managers that form the part of the sample may experience are outlined in the following table. And I think here it's again for department and say link between the official responsibilities and the private company and officials having multiple companies. I think what is more important as well to note is that as a clause that says when an official has got two or more companies, surely that official will not have enough time to begin to devote to his or her actual official duties. And that in its own is very, very problematic. And I think that's why we looked at that. And I think then we're seeing a number of those officials who are having such linkages and having those that are having multiple. And when we scrutinize these forms, in some, I mean, you'll see one having even more than 10 and so on and so forth, which according to the deed, to CPRO and then so on, they are all active. As shown in the table above, the relationship between the official responsibility of a senior manager and his or her interest in a private company poses the highest likelihood of potential conflicts of interest. In this regard, the PSC established 235 cases of senior managers who have interest in private companies whose functions are closely related to those of their departments. The PSC formed an opinion on the basis of the relationship between the work of the designated official and that of the private company the official is involved. For example, a senior manager who has shares in a company related to arts and is employed by the Department of Arts and Culture. A further 259 cases of potential conflicts of interest were as a result of senior managers having directorships or shares in multiple companies. This raises concerns about the amount of time that such an official would be able to devote to his or her full employment in the public service. The view of the PSC is that there's nothing wrong in having a private interest. However, it is to be expected that there will be occasions when an official's private interest will come into conflict with his or her public duties, thereby becoming an actual conflict of interest. Such actual conflicts of interest should be avoided. Where conflicts of interest cannot be reasonably avoided, they should be appropriately managed. The scrutiny of the disclosure forms of heads of departments, because I think that's another important part that we bring to this dimension to say, if heads of the department who are responsible to ensure that the senior managers submit are not actually submitting themselves, or they are actually involved in a number of such activities, how are they going to ensure that officials below them are not? Officials on the scrutiny of this, findings on the scrutiny of the disclosures of HODs, again, per department, where we are seeing that number of heads of department, out of those that we sampled at the time, 39 of them, number of disclosure received, 26. That also simply means there are HODs that do not submit their financial disclosures by the due date. And then again, the information coming across in terms of the linkages that they have with the private companies or where they have got the identification of companies or sharing such responsibilities. I think this table, again, is showing across all the provinces, apart from those that we have only scrutinized, but all of them, because we still scrutinize all of them despite those that are only assembled within a particular financial year. The scrutiny of the disclosures of heads of department was done on the same basis as was the case with SMS members. For this purpose, the PSC assessed the disclosures based on information on the disclosure forms, the CPRO database, and the deeds register. The PSC found, in terms of its assessment of the disclosures of heads of department, that 44 heads of department, or HODs, may have potential conflicts of interest linked to the work of their department. 41 HODs are involved in too many companies and 11 HODs share companies with their counterparts in other departments. And surely there you can be able to identify potential challenges in this regard. It was further found that 26 HODs did not disclose their properties. This is in direct contravention of the framework and calls for disciplinary action in terms of the disciplinary code and procedures of the SMS handbook. In cases where heads or HODs are involved in private companies and where the activities of the companies are linked to the work of the departments, they risk the danger of taking decisions that will favor their companies. And where HODs share companies with their counterparts, the possibility is that these heads of departments will make decisions that favor one another. On the other hand, the involvement of HODs in too many companies, three or more, puts the ability to devote full attention to the official duties into question. This based on the fact that Section 30 of the Public Service Act, 94 as amended, stipulates that every official shall place the whole of his or her time at the disposal of the state. The view is that should an official be involved in three or more companies, or he or she will not, in all probabilities, have the time to devote his or her full attention to the requirements of the state in terms of his or her official responsibility. And I think based on this, the PSC is of the view that heads of department, as leaders in their departments, should set the example with regard to the framework. Therefore, HODs have the power to disburse public funds and to authorize programs. As accounting officers, they are also exposed to privileged and sensitive information. Therefore, their actions should be accompanied by a greater transparency and accountability. There will also be an expectation of greater ethical leadership on HODs. The PSC is of the view that HODs should express such expectation through concrete ethical actions in the daily performance of their duties. We have generated the following recommendations, Honorable Jefferson of the Portfolio Committee and the members of the committee. Key to our recommendations are the following. Charging members of the SMS with misconduct. The PSC recommends that executive authorities should ensure that transgressing heads of department and other members of SMS are charged with misconduct for failing to disclose their financial interests in terms of disciplinary code and procedures as contained in the SMS handbook for not complying with the financial disclosure framework. The executive authorities should also inform the PSC of any steps taken in this regard, and if no steps were taken, state the reasons thereof. And I can tell you with these recommendations, Honorable Chair and members, we haven't received much of joy because we don't get a sense of what are the actions that have been taken and letters of reminders of even following up to establish if such actions have been taken have never been responded to the Public Service Commission. Disclosures of private companies and closed corporations, a total of 210 members of SMS failed to disclose their directorships and partnerships in private companies and closed corporations. This is in contravention with the Chapter 3 of Public Service Regulations, and it is recommended that EAs charge transgressing heads of department and ensure that other members of SMS are charged with the misconduct for failing to disclose their registrable interests by instructing their heads of department to do so. It is further recommended that members of the SMS be made aware of the fact that they need to disclose all companies, including dormant and non-profit-making companies. Companies for which senior managers are performing work but are not receiving the remuneration must also be disclosed. Instances where such managers have been charged with misconduct must also be reported to the PSC for filing purposes that will also be brought to the attention of honorable members going forward. Strengthening conflicts of interest regulation. Through this overview, the PSC has come to realize that there is a gap in the regulations regarding the participation of SMS members in government contracts. It came to light in this overview that SMS members have companies which regularly interact with government departments by obtaining contracts. However, there is no provision that regulates such interaction. The Institute for Security Studies in its research found that at local level, restrictions on elected officials tendering for municipal contracts is controlled in terms of the Municipal Finance Management Act. At the national and provincial level, however, the Public Finance Management Act fails to regulate the same activity. The PSC therefore recommends that the Public Finance Management Act should be amended to provide for the regulation of private companies linked to public officials and doing business with government. And finally, monitoring by portfolio committees. The PSC recommends that given their legislative and parliamentary oversight role, the portfolio committee should call departments and executive authorities to account where there's been non-compliance, as well as low levels of compliance to the financial disclosure framework. And in conclusion, we say the management of potential conflict of interest forms an integral part in the public service initiatives to become integrity-driven. Through the identification and management of potential conflict of interest, honest public servants are kept honest and professional ethics is promoted within the workplace. Compliance to the framework should therefore not be seen purely as a mandatory requirement, but as an ethical obligation of each and every senior manager. Moreover, a disclosure framework should be regarded as part of a larger effort to regulate conflicts of interest situations in the public service. While it is a crucial tool for preventing and controlling abuse of office by public servants, it cannot deal with full range of conflict of interest situations that emerge at departmental level. However, the framework has assisted in raising awareness among public servants for the need to be transparent and accountable in the execution of their official duties. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Public Service Commission. I think, Honorable Members, you have seen this and it's now being presented. Can I get any issues that require clarity or questions before we actually map up a way forward and then move to the next presentation, Honorable Williams?
Thank you, Chair. I have a few questions. I just want to know, when you say that the financial interests are scrutinized, I just want to know, does the Public Service Commission investigate a few of these disclosures every year to see if they're true or not? For instance, I could write down, you know, I own two companies and meanwhile I own five companies, or I've got interests in five companies. So I'd like to know whether or not they're actually really looking at not just whether they've complied, but whether they actually investigate that and look into a few just randomly. The other one is a question for the department. It seems that reminders are not enough, charges are not being made, and there's no disciplinary action. I'd like to know, what is the department going to do to address this? Also for the for the department, I'd like to know whether or not the anti-corruption unit is going to investigate a few of the potential conflicts of interest. In other words, then you come up with the Public Service Commission comes up with a number of potential conflicts of interest, but does anybody know if there's actually something dodgy happening there, and is the anti-corruption unit going to be involved in that? And lastly, I just want to say that I think the recommendations are fantastic and that we should all work to implement them. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Williams. Honorable Mohale.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question will be on the sampling. What kind of sampling are they using? Is it random sampling or any other sampling? Or do they see a trend to say, with these departments, there's usually non-disclosure and follow up with that department, or they'll sample this financial year and then the next financial year change to the other department? Because I think the other thing that they should check is on the trend, whether there's an improvement or not. And then my second question would be, is the PSC saying to us that since they've been scrutinizing these financial disclosure forms, no action at all has been taken since they've been doing this? And okay, thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks. Honorable Ponskelzik.
Thank you, Chair. Surely senior managers, HRDs, etc., are aware of the fact that compliance is obligatory. What are the reasons they give for not complying? Surely the EAs ask the people to do it and then they still don't do it. What are the reasons for not complying. And then, Chair, quickly, as far as monitoring by portfolio committees is concerned, the PSC recommends that portfolio committees should call departments and EAs to account. Can this portfolio committee, for instance, call any of the departments to account, also the provincial department? Thank you.
Honorable Suka.
Thank you, Chairperson. I must appreciate this report. Though it's a report for 2008-2009, and I worry that when it is reported in the public domain, it would be as if it is yesterday's report. That's my only concern, first and foremost. I would have been pleased, Chairperson, if this report were given. It was the last year's financial year, whilst you are working on this one, so that at least we come closer to the truth. The reason why I'm raising this matter, you'll remember in our budget debate, when we were lambasted, in fact the department was lambasted, as if these things are happening now in terms of the financial disclosures, and now we are getting this almost 3 years behind. So maybe a comparison between this report and the report of 2010-2011, we should be given that scenario so that we can check how far are you, because this is your entry point, your baseline, when you entered in doing this work. But as you speak, where are we in as far as this? So I'm appealing to get almost the latest one, because I know they are still working with the other one, of this current one. The second issue, Chairperson, for me, it seems to me there is a gap when it comes to the application in as far as the disciplinary procedures are concerned. You see, because they are raising these matters without having a teeth to bite. And I think we need to be told here, where should we improve in having that teeth as this department? Look, I appreciate also they have identified that at a local level, in terms of their act, they are very restrictive, they control. But when you come to the PFMA, we are very quiet. Where does it deliver it? So in other words, they are saying we must review that act so that it has a teeth to bite. It's of no use being alarmist and without being executive, you know, in terms of your authority. I think I like that recommendation. Even to us, your bullet, the penultimate bullet point that directs the committee, name and shame, but also we need to be firm. In other words, there's more work for this committee to be very robust on this matter, because we are being reduced in a subtle way to become a banana republic where officials will do as they wish without being held accountable. And we get so embarrassed in the chamber when we are having these debates, because this is a public document at the end of the day. Now, if so many of our officials have not disclosed, I'm saying, Chairperson, two things. The law, we need to ponder it, to tamper with it, so that also this issue of the name and shame, calling those departments, I think also it stretches our mandate to go to as far as the provinces are concerned. Well, once you speak of HODs, immediately it goes to provinces. We cannot abdicate our responsibility because it resides with us here. So we need to develop a program at a particular point. Otherwise, the comparative reports, this is too old yet, because you've done some strides. Maybe there is an improvement. We might be unfair to those who were weak, and yet we have not dealt with that. So that's my only concern, Chairperson. Thank you.
Okay. I think before there is a response from the department, just to also indicate that I also have interest largely from all the issues, from most issues that members have raised, more especially the issue of when the department responds, you know, there was, I think it's you, Honorable Williams, if I'm not wrong,
who talks of the anti-corruption unit's role within the whole process. I would be interested to actually find out, is there a collaborative role that can be played, as was posed by Honorable Williams. There was also the issue of timing. You know that Honorable Suka just raised it now, that, you know, the timing, that I would really like to get a response from the Public Service Commission. There's an issue, again, of the methodology. I'm sure it comes from you, Honorable Mohale. What kind of method have you used? Just to emphasize those, but all the questions that members have posed, I would request that they are responded to, because all of them are critical. Is it the department that will want to go first, or is it the Public Service Commission? Department of Public Service and Administration?
Let the Public Service Commission go first.
Okay.
Well, I was just double checking if my principal in the form of commission has wanted to take a first bite before I.
Just looking at you, I'm sure you can proceed. Am I right, Honorable Mtembo? Oh, okay. Can I allow the commissioner?
Commissioner Mtembo.
Chairperson, I just need to respond to the first question, which is whether we actually verify the disclosures. Indeed, we do. 30% sampling. We sample in order, firstly, to see whether, as indicated, whether a person is involved in two or three companies. Secondly, whether they have fully disclosed. We don't just take the disclosure form at face value and accept that. That is why we go to the commission, former CIPRO, the commission on, yes, that one. Yes, so that we are certain. In fact, in some instances, we do pull out and identify instances where people have not fully disclosed, and we engage in executive authorities on that, and actually insist on disciplinary action. So I just needed to take that one.
Just a quick one on CIPRO too. You know, I don't know what sort of influence or power you might have on CIPRO. We sometimes pick up problems where the data of CIPRO is outdated, and it really tarnishes the integrity of our reports, because sometimes you might say this person is in this company, but that company is dormant already. But on the system, it's like it's still active. So I don't know how we can also try to talk to CIPRO in such a way that they're able to jack up their work too, because this is very important work that we are doing. And we don't want to get these reports out there in the public domain and only to find that some of the information can be disputed, because we trust that CIPRO is also doing its work. So we rely on that information, on those databases, and it's very important that information is accurate too.
Just on the concerns expressed by the Honorable Member around the time lapse when the assessment was made for the financial year 2008-2009, and then now we are speaking 2011, what's relevant? It is quite true, it's a genuine concern. The challenge that we're having as a commission is this, that a financial year starting 1st of April in 2008 and end up the 31st March 2009, and then we must take a decision as a PSC to look, you know, they must first, you know, submit and everything, and then we must get in. There's a question of collecting the information, which is also a problem. Now, by the time now you complete, you know, the study, then the next financial year is 2000, the 1st of April 2009 to 2010. and then now you have to conduct another one. So obviously there will be that time lapse. But it is quite true that now that time lapse may actually give, you know, it cannot really give or depict the accuracy of the state of affairs. So we'll take that into consideration. I think probably what we need to do, you know, to deal with this kind of time lapse, probably is to issue what we sometimes do, a fact sheet, you know, which is much easier. It doesn't involve a research collection, but the available data is simple, just thrown as it is, you know, a snapshot. And then in that way, you will be able to balance, you know, this question. I think you're quite correct there. I'll ask our officials to deal with some of the issues here, methodological issues that have been raised. The question of what else is right, I've addressed that one. Yeah, I think there are about two questions that are outstanding here that need some reaction.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. I think in terms of the sampling, in order to cover the entire public service, we ensure that on a yearly basis, the provinces or the department that we might have selected this year, we're not going to select the following year, or perhaps even 2 years in a row, to ensure that we have covered all of the provinces and all the departments. I think the point that the Honorable raised is that some of those that might be having red lights, perhaps they might want immediate revisit. I think going forward methodologically, we might want to consider that, and I think it can be done. In terms of the, that is it pretty much still the same state? Yes, because the challenge we have is the response from the EAs once we have informed them of the status of the compliance in their department. Because according to this act, the EAs will also write back to the PSC and say they've noted the information provided by the PSC, and therefore this is what they've done or going to do with those officials implicated in terms of asking them to double-check what is the nature of the activities and whether it has got any potential conflict of interest. Because we are bringing that to the attention for that particular understanding. And I think information-wise, we might have received work with poor response rate from the EAs. And I think that's why we started by saying, despite reminders by both the PSC and the Minister of Public Service Administration, that hasn't been satisfactory up to so far. In terms of the trends, as much as this could be 8-9, I can share this with honorable members. We do have the 9-10 one completed, but even the current one that we're completing, that is still has to go to the Commission for approval, the understanding or the trends are still pretty much within the same range. The compliance rate is still problematic. The disclosure itself by the official is still problematic. The response from the EA is still very problematic. And we are likely to still generate more of the same recommendations, perhaps with even tighter suggestions. But we are still hovering the same range of the challenges in terms of the situation. And I think one of the things that we have even done that I can share with the Commission, with the Portfolio Committee, is that as of the current financial year, the one that ended where they were expected to have submitted by the 31st of May, we sent SMS as an initiative to all heads of department much earlier in February and even March, trying to warm up the HODs to say, by the way, by the 30th, it will be the due day for the submission of the financial disclosure forms and to the EAs. We even put several ads on the papers, national papers for that matter, and even local papers, where we're raising the same awareness so that we can say, from the PSC point of view, we are conscientizing constantly the officials and the EAs in terms of the compliance with this exercise. And I'm sure we'll continue to do so because we're still of the view that 100% is attainable, it can be done, but there are role players that should play in order to achieve that. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Govender? Okay. You want to say something, Commissioner Elepi?
Yes, thanks. Just to add, some of the questions asked are, what are the reasons, you know, forwarded by departments for not complying, you know? We simply collect the forms from them and say to the EAs, look, here's the position with regards to your HOD, you know. Can you indicate to us what you're doing? We always give departments 6 months to respond. We always give departments 6 months to respond to recommendations made by the Public Service Commission. And the Minister of Public Administration, Public Service and Administration once said, you know what, the PSC always complains that it doesn't have teeth. But it has teeth, but they are somewhere else. And what I'm trying to say, they grow, she said, they grow outside the mouth, to paraphrase it. Now, what he was in effect saying was that this is where our teeth, our set of teeth is, because we report to Parliament. So this is what we are saying today, that Parliament, here are the facts. Please assist us to call those departments to account. Why EAs don't take action against people who are transgressing obligatory stipulations in our law. It's as simple as that, because we need really to work together in that regard. And we find it difficult, you know, if we have to do just the paperwork of to and throwing your dear colleague letters. I mean, we've reached a stage where we say, but I mean, this is the law, it must be complied with. Committees such as these, please help us to do that. And that is exactly what we are asking from you. Call people to account. Let them give reasons why they are not acting in a particular way when the law says they should act in a particular way. So we're looking forward to a situation where we would indicate to you after 6 months, that period which we put, that here are the recommendations to Department A. They haven't complied. Please ask them why they haven't complied. They call them to account. So I'm looking forward to a process like that. We're looking forward to a process like that so that we also develop a continuous working relationship with this committee, not only when we present reports, but when we follow up on the recommendations of those reports. And that is very important, that we really continue that relationship as quickly as possible.
Just a quick follow-up. Should compliance not form part or be included in a senior manager's performance agreement?
It's through you, Chairperson. It's a natural consequence of working in the public service. There are rules, regulations, there are laws which must be complied with, because we always argue that laws, regulations, and the directives are enabling mechanisms for a specific purpose, to achieve a specific purpose. So if a public official does not follow prescribed laws and regulations, what exactly is that public official trying to achieve, which cannot be achieved by following those regulations? So it's obvious that you work within specific parameters in the public service, and compliance is key to them for predictability, for also achievement of specific objectives. So there it comes, what do they say? It comes with a trade, you know, in the public service.
Okay. Commissioner...
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Yeah, just to add on what the Commissioner Halep has pointed out, I think you're quite correct with the suggestion that the question of submission should form part of performance management and system. In fact, the Commission has made that particular recommendation, that now when HODs and senior management are being assessed, you know, annually, one of the issues to be looked at is the extent to which they comply with this. So again, it is a question of monitoring to see whether that recommendation is actually being implemented. Thank you.
Mr. Governor.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. I'll be very quick. Just to indicate from our side as DPSA, we must first accept that the regulatory environment with regard to financial disclosures is a decentralized environment. The responsibility to ensure it is done, the responsibility to ensure that disciplinary action or any other action is taken, rests with the executing authorities and heads of departments. It doesn't rest with anyone else, and that's part of the difficulty we find ourselves in. The report that was presented by the Public Service Commission, I want to indicate that DPSA has taken note of a number of the recommendations that are already there, and we've integrated that into what we're calling the Draft Public Sector Integrity Management Framework, which will be tabled in Parliament very soon, which hopefully closes the number of gaps raised by the Public Service Commission. We've taken a number of other steps, Madam Chair, to try and address them. We've also developed guidelines on the remunerative work outside of the public service and how to manage that in the public service, and we're seeing some benefits in that particular regard. I want to just point out that in terms of the report presented by the Commission, we must separate financial disclosures and from those that are receiving remuneration as part of their partnerships or directorships. One thing is to declare your interest or your partnership or directorship. But if there's any remunerative or any income from those partnerships, there's a separate process in terms of applying for that money to receive those funds. So there's these two separations that we need to take into account. We are also working with the performance management system to try and ensure that officials at senior management level who do not provide their financial disclosure forms on time will not qualify for performance bonuses in that year. The challenge, Madam Speaker and Honourable Members, is that what is an appropriate sanction for managers who do not submit their forms on time? Now, many of the departments have been issuing letters of warning, letters of final warning to managers for not submitting their forms. Now, we all know those letters of warning and letters of final warning sit in your file for 6 months, and then they expunge. Now, you submit once a year. So it doesn't really have any value. So we need to ensure that there is an appropriate sanction linked to non-compliance. And that's what we're trying to manage. Very similar to the amendment to the performance management system, that where you do not sign your performance agreement by due date, by the end of June, you do not qualify for pay progression. So there's a financial sanction against senior managers, which we're trying to put in place. We're also trying to amend the requirements, which says you need to submit a new financial disclosure form every time your financial circumstances changes, so that there's a continuation in for the entire year, not wait for one of the years. Wait for the end of the year. Then the final point I just want to make from our side is that we're busy working with CETA, and we're hoping to have it in place for next year, is an electronic fining system for the public service. So then we don't have to wait a year later to get information. We'll be able to pick up the information immediately upon closure of the date in which they need to submit. So that electronic filing system will be in place, and in that we will have the required links. One of the links is to CIPRO. So we'll be able to do the electronic comparison in that sense. The final comment from our side, Madam Speaker, is that we need to also just caution in terms of the comparison of information. Closure date is the 31st of May, and the request from CIPRO may be at a later date, and circumstances change. So we need to make sure that the information is as at a certain date. As well as, for example, I see 9,000 senior managers on the list. We need to separate professionals that are paid at senior management level and senior managers that are senior, because the obligation to submit a financial disclosure form is not at a professional level. For example, your chief cardiologist does not submit a financial disclosure, but a senior manager at salary level 14 submits. So we need to just separate those two as well in terms of figures. Thanks.
I think honourable members, I just needed to warn that we've got three other reports to go, but I understand that issues are critical, and I definitely want to do a proposal and a suggestion. I was trying to draw attention, raise that I think the last report, it would have been possible for us to take it. We, if members agree with me, Can we just defer the last report, that means the seventh consolidated public service monitoring and evaluation, to another meeting, but we focus on the three reports that are here. Okay, I wonder if members still want to have all, because there is a recommendation as well that we're going to make based on this, which therefore means that the first meeting that I would request public service and the Department of Public Service and Administration to sit down and clean out on issues that they think they need to be sort of cleaned out, because we want this resubmission on those areas. Our intention as a committee is to call all the committees that constitute the class of governance, particularly Auditor General, ourselves, Public Safety and Administration Committee, the SCOPA, to collaborate in terms of a follow-up meeting where we'll be doing oversight thoroughly on these matters. And therefore, I will appreciate a situation where the Public Service Commission had already sat with the Department of Public Safety and Administration, and they forward to us any recommendations and in terms of areas that they actually, if they are sort of amending some areas or they're finding a solution on other areas, we would need that as urgently as possible, and therefore we need them to sit and draw that draw those recommendations after the discussions, because we're taking up this matter in particular as a governance cluster. We don't have official clusters as yet in Parliament, but we do collaborate as committees in a cluster fashion in terms of dealing with matters of this nature. And therefore, all issues that what we need to do a follow-up, we'll follow up in a cluster fashion. And therefore, can I then request that we move to the next report? Because it's not a closed matter, and it cannot be closed at this level. We will take all issues off. If we have to call the DGs, definitely the cluster will do that thoroughly, because that's what we'll be working on. But as Parliament vested with the task of doing the monitor, of doing the oversight, we know how to do our oversight, and we do have various plans in terms of upping our oversight task. And therefore, part of it is the cluster fashion. And therefore, we would really need that to be done. Can I then request that we close this close the issue on the first report on the matter that on the issue that it's not final, it's going to be proceeded on other levels, and then we take the next report. Okay. Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, the next report is a report of the Public Service Commission submitted to us in Parliament on the Consolidated Monitoring and Evaluation Report for the Department of Housing, which is a human settlement as we know it. That's the evaluation cycle for 2009 to 2010 to July 2010. Can I then request, I don't know if we will take a break immediately after this report. My apologies, I just want us to focus on this. Can we then, if we are ready, take the next report? The Public Service Commission will indicate if they are ready. And then, Commissioner Mthembu, if you are ready, you will just...
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, members of the Portfolio Committee. Chairperson, as we are all aware, that the Public Service Commission is mandated by the Constitution to promote good governance. And in our understanding of good governance, we think that the nine democratic principles and values that are enumerated under Section 195 actually define what we mean by good governance, those principles. Now, the Constitution also empowers us to monitor, to evaluate, to assess, so that we are able to do to fulfill our mandate of promoting those values. Now, with a view to do that, the Public Service Commission has developed a framework for the assessment of these values in the public service since 2000. Now, in terms of this a system of evaluating the extent to which departments are complying with these prescribed principles, we develop standards as well as indicators, and then we are able to assess, put a mark, and then in that way we are then able to draw a conclusion in terms of whether we're making progress. But also very importantly is the fact that we are able to identify weaknesses as well as strengths, and then make recommendations accordingly for improvement. That being the case, in the evolution cycle 2009 and 2010, we took a decision as a Public Service Commission to assess the extent to which the Department of Housing, or what we call today a human settlement, you know, is actually adhering or complying with those principles and values, and therefore promoting good governance. This is very important given the fact that housing is one of the basic needs. The issue of shelter is in fact something that is very critical in terms of our constitution or democratic constitution, in the sense that now it's a developmental issue. It's not just a shelter, there's a question of protection, there's a question of sustainable development, and that is a context in which human settlement is understood. And therefore, when we address the issue of human dignity, which is entrenched in our constitution, it is very important that we look at this. It is quite clear that we're having a well-established policy framework. It's very, very good. And there's no doubt about that, you know. And it's also quite clear that there are a lot of resources that have been channeled to them. The challenge that we're having is a question of implementation. And it is in that context that we look and we have assessed this area, that is housing. Towards that end, we have therefore assessed the 10 departments, one national and each and every provincial department. And then we came to a particular findings as recommendations. Chairperson, I would tell you now to request the Chief Director, Kobus van der Merwe, to make a presentation on the consolidated monitoring and evaluation report on the Department of Human Settlement for the 2009-2010 evaluation cycle. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. A while ago, the Public Service Commission came to this committee with its State of the Public Service report. And this committee then, in response, prepared a detailed report of their own on our report. And we really take note of the report of the Portfolio Committee, and we welcome all the responses, and especially such a detailed response that we get from our stakeholders on our reports. Now, some of the remarks that the committee made on that State of the Public Service report is that the report is confusing, but then it specifically said they want the report to report against a consistent set of indicators and it should be clear which departments we are reporting on. Now, our M&E system does exactly that, and that's why I sort of am happy to present this report, because these departments, in this case now the 10 housing departments or human settlement departments, are evaluated against a specific set of indicators, and we name the departments. The two reports are actually the wrong way around in this on the program of the Commission. The other report is the seventh consolidated report. Now, in the 2009-10 cycle, we evaluated 30 departments. And that sample was made up of 10 housing departments so that we can say something about a whole sector. And because it's similar departments, we can compare like with like. We also did all the departments in the Northwest province. So there's a third consolidated report in this cycle, which is sort of a state of the province report, where we go department by department for all the departments in the Northwest. In the year, we are currently completing reports on the agriculture sector and all the premier's offices. In the coming year, we will do all the social development departments. So I'm just emphasizing we can give you scores and assessments of quite a number of departments. If we take our evaluations from the start of the system, we've by now done about 150 departments. So what we can do in this presentation, we can, in the first instance, rank departments, and I'll give you the ranking of these 10 departments. But we can also compare them with their current assessment, the 9-10 assessment, with a previous assessment. The previous assessment would have been done in different years. We didn't do the previous assessment in a specific year. And then I'll also tell you a little bit about the performance per principle. We can also split the performance according to the values in Section 195 of the Constitution. So the purpose of this consolidated report is to give an overview of the national departments and the 9 provincial housing departments' performance against the 9 values. Perhaps just also to quickly explain the system, we have designed our system around the 9 values. For each of the 9 values, we have set 1 or 2 performance indicators. For each of the indicators are then further broken down to a number of standards, and linked to each of the standards is a score. So we can then score departments, and you'll see for the 10 departments we have rated 1 as excellent, 1 as good, 6 adequate performance, and 2 poor performance. I'm happy to say that that our colleague from National Housing, National Human Settlements, which is in the room, the second, the good department there, the one under the category of good, is the National Human Settlement Department. The excellent department is the Western Cape Department of Human Settlements, but I'll get to that now. The second thing that we can do with our system, we can compare performance with a previous assessment. If you look at our graph there on the presentation, you'll see that all the 10 departments except 2 have improved their performance. So I think that is a very positive thing that can come out of this M&E assessment. Departments generally have improved their performance. The only department where there was a slight reduction in performance was the Limpopo department, from 52% to 49%, and that is not a significant decrease in performance. And the Northwest department was more or less maintained its performance, but that is in the category of poor, 31-32% there in the last two bars. Five of the seven departments have improved their performance with 10% and more. The Western Cape from good to excellent, the National Department from 63 to 76, Northern Cape from poor to adequate, Mpumalanga from poor to adequate, Free State from poor to adequate. Two departments, like I said, no real improvement in performance was noted. Now, if one analyzes now the performance per principle, there you see the scores with the highest score for accountability of 75% and the lowest score for impartiality and fairness of 31%. And I'll, in the next slide, go principle by principle. And I'll just go through six of them, the three highest and the three lowest scoring principles. Accountability was the highest, followed by transparency with 68% and development orientation with 67%. Then the low scoring principles was good human resource management practices, 39%, representativity, 37%, and fairness, 31%. This also gives me the opportunity to quickly explain our system. Accountability, we have two performance indicators there. We check whether the department has adequate internal financial controls and whether there are fraud prevention plans based on a thorough risk assessment and whether those fraud prevention plans are implemented. The score for accountability was 75%. Seven of the 10 departments received an unqualified audit opinion, and that is one of the reasons for a high score. We try with our system not necessarily to only rely on our own information collection. So if our indicator is a thing like adequate internal financial control, we rely to a large degree there on the audit opinion. The Department of Human Settlement uses the housing subsidy system to monitor performance. Even though KwaZulu-Natal said they experienced challenges with using the system as a project management system or a project management tool, and the Northern Cape said the system is highly bureaucratic, too many elaborate procedures. There was an 86% compliance with the requirements of the Good Fraud Prevention Plan. Importantly, though departments produce monthly management reports on many aspects, few management teams provide feedback on these reports. Many of our standards check the one against the other. So we might ask, is there management reporting? But then we will also ask just to check what happens with that management report. We will ask the department, okay, what action is taken on this management report. And in many instances, we find that the score for submission of management or the existence of management reports might be high, but as soon as we check what action is taken on the reports, the score might be lower. Transparency. We have two indicators there. The one is the quality of the department's annual report, and the second indicator is compliance with the Access to Information Act. The department scored on average 68% here. They generally complied with the key requirements of the annual report, a key requirement of the annual report, namely that performance should be against predetermined objectives. That requirement comes from the Public Finance Management Act. But one could have expected better or more meaningful information in these annual reports, and I give a few examples there. More meaningful information around housing delivery could have been provided. For example, the number of houses completed reported separately from those under construction, the proportion and number of properties that have been transferred to their occupiers, the value of the housing, norms around average construction time. This was also a finding of the Financial and Fiscal Commission. And we do take note of other reports of other bodies. Compliance with the Promotion of Access to Information Act, still not satisfactory. Development orientation. Our indicator there is the department is effectively involved in programs or projects that aim to promote development and reduce poverty. The score there was 67%. The departments generally complied with the PSC standards. Seven of the departments could show beneficiary participation in the design and implementation of projects. Project management was generally of an acceptable standard. The departments, when they do housing plans, they do consider the integrated development plans of the municipalities. They sometimes not make optimal use of that information, though. For example, KwaZulu-Natal, the Zululand district, the housing committee identified projects in their wards worth 800 million rand, whilst the budget for the province as a whole is also 800 million rand. So those housing sector plans in the integrated development plans not always realistic. And the departments always didn't always make intelligent use of those housing sector plans. Six of the 10 departments had a procedure in place to record lessons learned and applying these lessons in future projects. We say it's very important with monitoring and evaluation that one learns out of any evaluation that takes place. And six of the 10 departments did sort of apply lessons of completed projects in future projects. Government has set development objectives for housing beyond the mere provision of a house. Housing values have increased by between 13% and 57% between 2003 and 2008, depending on the area. 35,000 jobs have been created. Slightly more female-headed households benefited from the housing program than male-headed households. But for some beneficiaries, the experience of formalization has actually increased their financial burden since they spend their limited resources paying rates and services. But now going to the to three of the principles where the scores were much worse. The first one, good human resource management and career development practices. We have two indicators there. The first one is on recruitment. And we especially check the time it takes to fill a vacancy. And then we also assess the department's skills development planning process and whether that complies with the provision of the Skills Development Act. The score for this principle was 39%. Many times departments do have skills development plans, but there's poor implementation of those plans. None of the departments could fill a post within 90 days, which is the standard that that the PSC applies. It takes the human settlement departments on average 339 days to fill a post. And that is nearly a year. And we view this this indicator of the time it takes to fill a post, it measures the efficiency of the recruitment process. But we want to say that we want to generalize from a finding like this. If a process, if a basic process like a recruitment process is taking so long, probably many other processes in the department is also taking long. So though our indicator sort of focuses on recruitment, we want with this system to generalize about performance. Going to representativity, The indicator is the department is representative of the South African people and is implementing diversity management measures. The average score here was 37%. The main reason for that is that two of the national representativity targets, namely the target for women and the target for disabled people, were generally not met. It is encouraging, though, that the previous target for women, which was 30%, all the departments have met that target, but they haven't met the new target of 50% yet. And then lastly, going to the principle of fairness, where the departments scored the lowest. And our indicator for this fairness principle is compliance with the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. The average score here was only 31%. The main reason for the poor performance is that 7 out of the 10 departments did not submit information for assessment against this principle. Now, we argued the key administrative decision that housing departments apply is allocation of houses, the whole waiting list process. And in defense of the departments who didn't submit information, is that decision is not, strictly speaking, taken by the provincial human settlement departments. That decision is taken on the municipal level, on the local government level. But we nevertheless would have expected that that there are many, that the provincial departments and also the national department, but especially the provincial departments, should have given more guidance and should have monitored this decision-making process more closely, the decision-making process that takes place on the municipal level. Because the housing allocation process is many times experienced by the public out there as unfair. So our low score reflects the fact that we expected provincial departments to have done more to make sure that that process happens correctly, even though they themselves, strictly speaking, are not taking the decision. And in this slide, if you are interested, we just explains that decision-making process around the allocation of houses. And that is then the last principle that I want to sort of focus on. To conclude then, the emerging picture is one of departments struggling to institutionalize sound administrative processes, which will allow them to manage towards and realize proper policy outcomes. The scoring is generally still fairly low. We say it's adequate, but very few departments was excellent and good. So we still see departments struggling to institutionalize their processes. Encouraging, though, is that there was improvement in performance. If we compare the departments with their previous performance, basically all of them, or most of them, have improved the performance. And where there was no improvement, it more or less stayed the same. The challenge facing the public housing sector is not a lack of instruments, mechanisms, and institutions to manage policy outcomes, but the institutionalization of systems and performance and the performance culture, as well as the capacity and the will of staff members to implement policies and systems. And I think it also linked to the previous questions under compliance with a simple thing like submission of financial disclosures. It's not that the rules and the systems are not there. It's institutionalizing that performance culture, that no-fault culture, and that generally also applies to housing. Thank you very much.
So that's the Chief Director from Public Service Commission.
Maybe before we get into the matters that have been raised by the report, I just need us to go back to your opening remarks. You know, I don't know whether you were mandated by the commissioners on that, because it's a very serious matter on our side. And therefore, I'm not sure because it wasn't related to this report, but it's a matter that we have actually scheduled a meeting with the commissioners where we had to discuss on it. I don't know whether you want to amplify that so that we understand exactly what you're saying on that opening.
Yeah, now, the purpose was simply to show or to emphasize that the consolidated reports, of which we had three this year, are exactly reports which is based on a fixed set of indicators and where we name specifically the department that we are evaluating. So I'm simply emphasizing that as an introduction.
The reference was made to the state of the...
Yeah, so I'm emphasizing that in that regard, the consolidated reports differ from the state of the public service report.
Chairperson, we just had a little caucus here. I think that let us have the discussion at the scheduled meeting of that matter, the matter that was on the report that was on the ATC and the recommendation there. As you indicated, let's have the discussion
I think I'll take your word because that's too serious, particularly on our side. It's a matter that really discuss. If it's thrown like this, for us it's problematic as the committee. We, you know, unless if there's scheduled discussions on the matter, but yes, of course, we want to engage. You know, because maybe lastly what one would say, if the public service report, it has to call its report the state of the public service, it should give a full picture. That's my opinion of the public service, but you see, that's why I don't want us. It's an engaging matter, which we need to engage, you know, because more especially we're going to work quite closely together with the Public Service Commission. And therefore, yeah, I think also, once, you know, let's focus on what we're called to do rather than opening up issues at other levels, because that was not a level for that. That's what I just needed to indicate. Can you then go back to the matter of the day, the matter that's on the table? Are there questions on the matter? With Honorable Williams' hand up, any other member who wants to raise anything? Maybe let's start with yourself, Honorable Williams.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got two questions. The first one is around, has the PSC looked into the reasons why the Northern Cape has 55% performance and the Northwest, say, 32%? And if lessons can be learned from the better provinces to help the bad performers, you know, some sort of thing can happen. And the next point I just want to make is on page 16 of your slide, the last bullet refers to the last sentence in the last bullet. It says, it has even been argued by some analysts that informal housing may provide financially more viable options for the poor. And I just want to say that under no circumstances will informal housing ever be more viable for the poor people in South Africa. We can look at a very topical example where an analyst argued that toilets with no roofs will be more viable for the poor, and we've all learned that this is not the case. And I think that this government will never allow the poor to remain poor, and I think that the statement is irresponsible, and it doesn't reflect the government's position. So I don't know why this is in here, because it's very very misleading, this, and I'm a bit concerned about that. Thank you.
Honorable Williams, Honorable Mohal. Maybe in addition to Honorable Williams' first question about the differences in percentages, my worry is where you are saying Limpopo has declined with 3%, but you are saying it's still adequate, as if that adequate performance is satisfying, because my worry would be on the declining part. Why did it decline? What were the problems? We don't want this adequate, but you don't want to see any province declining, and it's my home province.
And then okay, and then on the other hand, I would like also to emphasize where you are saying this. I'm speaking to the department, the Human Settlement Department, where you are saying they don't follow the IDPs of municipalities, and that is true. Usually there's no representation during the IDPs forums and the IDP roadshows and so on from the Department of Human Settlement, because if they were part or they studied the IDPs of different municipalities, they would be able to read through to see where there's a need and also fill in that gap. The other question to the Department of Human Settlement is on the issue of that is why you will have a problem with fairness, where the municipality will identify the beneficiaries and they'll send different beneficiaries to the department, provincial departments, and some allocations will be made there, and you'll be having problems of fairness or unfairness, because not everybody who has applied will get that house. And people who really deserve those houses will be left out of the system. And those who deserve, but you see the differences, that those who deserve more than the others will be left out of the system. To say the department should also look into that. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Mohali. Honorable Suk.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is just one. On page 23, under fairness, before I ask my question, I just want some clarity on that page, especially on the first bullet point. Can I just get the understanding? Because there's a bold, also some words there that says as well as. So can I just get first and foremost my understanding on page 23? Under fairness, can you explain to me what that sentence means so that I get the point before I ask the question, Chairperson?
Okay. I think you can proceed with just that clarity.
I'm not sure exactly what the question is.
Okay, can you proceed to clarify the question, Honorable Sir?
Can you explain to me your bullet point? The first bullet point, because there are three bullet points, you know, or the asterisk, or what do you call it? Stars, or the asterisk. There are three, but the first one, prefaced by your example, can you just explain to me whether a housing project is undertaken, blah, 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 blah. What do you mean by that?
How do you interpret that
sentence? The sentence in bold.
No.
The sentence that starts with whether a housing project is under,
yeah,
in the area where special planning, da da da.
Yeah. In the decision making process, different factors are considered, and the sub bullets there. Whether a project is undertaken in that area or not, that's the first thing. So if one simply had a waiting list and there's 100 people on the waiting list, one would have expected number one on the waiting list get it first. But it's not as simple as that, because if there's no project in that specific area, then people in that area, even though they are on the waiting list, might wait longer for a project, for a house, than in other areas where housing projects are undertaken. So in this whole allocation decision-making process, just the simple fact whether a project is undertaken in an area also determines how quickly you will get a house or not. That's the first bullet. Then the second bullet that I've already also mentioned, your position on the waiting list will also determine how long you wait. And then the vulnerability of the beneficiary is also taken into account. So if there's if the beneficiary for some reason has more need of a house than another one, that might also determine the decision of the allocation of houses. So it's a fairly complicated decision, taking different factors into account, and we have listed there under the stars three of the factors that may influence when a person will get a house or how long he will wait to get a house. But the point we are making is not so much exactly how the decision-making process works, but we have scored departments low because they haven't checked sufficiently, in our view, that municipalities apply these criteria fairly.
Thank you, Chairperson. You see, the way it is explained now, I understand, but not fully. I think for me, the presentation, Chairperson, is quite good. But if you identify or you diagnose a problem or a challenge, surely as a person who is there, you should also bring some solutions thereof to turn around the situation. This is what we need to do. For instance, you just mentioned in one of your bullet points the 339 days just to fill in a vacancy. Now, you are not also advising us as to how to go about in reducing those 36 steps that are bureaucratic in filling in that post. So as a person who is diagnosing a challenge or a problem, what is lacking in the presentation is to say, how do we turn around that moving forward so as to be much more effective? Because also if you say it is a complicated matter in arriving at a particular decision, and without saying this is what we should do, it's a challenge for the committee, because you are the other, you are, what do you call, you're not really architects, but because you diagnose the problem, but surely you should have a solution thereof. What I advise, because you are just making mere statements here, taking from certain documentation without saying this is what we think you should go. That's my little concern. The gap is there, Chairperson. Thank you.
Okay, Honorable Nyagem.
Thank you, Chair. I think on the same point that has been raised by Honorable Suga, one was expecting that in this report, you will also give recommendations, because when you do assessment of anything that you do, you identify problematic areas and at the same time have some recommendations of how things can be turned around. For instance, the good example that has been made here of the Zululand municipality, where the needs developed in fact identified by that municipality around housing. It went to a level of 800 million rand, only to find out it's a municipality within a province. Then only to find that the budget for the province was equal to the needs of that municipality. So which then says the planning of departments at provincial level need to be informed by IDP processes. So I'm saying, I'm raising this, Madam Chair, in line with the point that Honorable Suga raised. Thank you.
If members have already put the issues, can I then proceed to the Public Service Commission?
A quick one on two questions. The issue that we always raise is that each of the Public Service Commission's reports should not be read in isolation to other reports. There are more in-depth reports. This is a consolidated report. So there were individual reports with specific recommendations. If you read individual reports, because of the peculiarity of different departments per province or nationally, there are specific recommendations for that particular department. So this is only a consolidated report of all of them. They are individual reports. Now, and so that is where you find all the detailed recommendations made, which are specific. Now, and I understand, you know, it would be difficult to bring consolidated recommendations also to the fore, you know, for us. But as I said, our reports are always available on our website. They are electronically available also on the PSC website. Now, the issue of also posts and the time it takes, as part of that process of MNEing department, monitoring and evaluating department, we use indicators which say, according to law, this is how long it should take to appoint people. This, according to our, to your documentation, you take this much. So why, what are the reasons which lead you to doing this? And there may be many. And we said, okay, in order to assist you to do that, we have a guideline on a selection and appointment. We have a guideline, you know, which we workshopped with many departments, I think it was 3-4 years ago, in terms of best practice. And in order for departments to meet the deadlines, you know, and the periods within which they should appoint. So the guidelines, the guidance is there. And also that those guidelines are also available on our website too. So that is why I'm saying, you know, it's very interesting on how these reports interrelate. Especially also with the HOD evaluation. It's really very interesting. So reading our report in isolation won't give you the broader picture of what issues are involved. That is why the interactions between ourselves are very important. So that we should bring forth other reports that add to what we already put on the table and more detail, because we are respectful and mindful of the time. That is why we did not add a lot of detail into our reports. But if you need us to come and present specific reports, we'll do so for more detail.
Honorable William.
Thanks, Chairperson. Just on that point, I think it's a little bit peculiar to come here and give us a report, and then when we challenge it, then to say to us, well, don't worry, the information is somewhere else. So, I mean, because it doesn't give us the information. We're relying on the Public Service Commission to give us the information in a, so that we can understand it properly and then make decisions on that. For you to say to us now, well, if you want the recommendations, you have to go and read all of our reports, and after you've read all those 6,000 pages, then you can carry on working. And I think that's a little bit unreasonable on your side. So perhaps when you do bring us reports like this, you should just have a one-page with your recommendations that you've just got from your other report, so it's just easier for us. Because if you must understand, we get tons and tons of information all the time, and it's, you know, thank you.
Can we go to human settlement? We'll come back to you. I can see your hand where it was up, Dr. Mapisana, but let's go to human settlement on matters that are raised, and what have they to say on the matter?
Chairperson, thank you once again. I think as the Department of Human Settlements, we welcome the report that was done by the Commission. And as always, we respect the recommendations that are made by the Commission. So we make a supportive effort to follow up with a view to correcting where we've gone wrong. Not only as national, but including the provincial departments, which we made in our technical min-max. So we are certainly going to take, I think we are pleased with the fact that on average we have performed adequately, but obviously there's areas that we need to improve very dramatically, and these are clear. We have taken cognizance of the provinces that haven't done well, especially those on the bottom line. Eastern Cape and the Northwest, we're going to engage with the HODs on that. This and I must confirm to this committee that these reports are also discussed with politicians at the MINMEC level, where the minister presents to the MECs. With regard to the principles, we also take cognizance of the deliberations of the PSC, and then where we perform badly in terms of human resources, human resource management, representativity, and impartiality. And the comment noted that on average takes us 300 days. Obviously, there is qualifications for that. The posts will differ, Chairperson. Some you can expedite very quickly, but there are some that maybe you're caught up in some processes. If you are restructuring the organization, you may not immediately feel. But the audit instrument of the PSC will not necessarily look favorable to that. They will say we stick to the rule book that says 90 days. So there are areas where we will explain those time of pay machines. But in general, we take the recommendations that are made by the PSC, and we'll seek to improve in the overall, all the areas that the Commission has raised. There's also two issues that Honorable from Limpopo, I think Honorable Member Mohale has made reflections. It is true that we had a slight decline in Limpopo of 3%. I have already SMS'd the HOD and say, HOD, this you must expect that we are going to come on you. So it's serious. We take it seriously, and it's true that we need to be gradually improving as government. We cannot allow ourselves to decline. So we will take that very seriously. With regard to the question around whether we participate in the IDP process, I would like to say, not necessarily differing with the Honorable Member, but we do take the IDP process and hearings very seriously. I know that on annual basis we'll have them run mostly at around Johannesburg, where all the in Cape Town Park, where all the departments come in, and we make a concerted effort to have all the provincial departments come and participate in those hearings. But certainly, in terms of housing, human settlement allocation, the IDP processes are the ones that in our housing plans of the municipalities are contained within the IDP plans of the municipality, and we take that when dealing with the planning part in terms of advising provinces in terms of allocations and where they must concentrate on. So we do take that very seriously. There's just one finding that is related to that regarding that first bullet there, that some of the pay machines is around the spread of people, where people are located relative to the project. We've got a standard criteria that determines eligibility, where people have to be South Africans above the age of 18, and they must have dependents and earning a salary at a certain range. We do follow that criteria, but certainly these are, if you like, Chairperson, consequential permutations. For example, we cannot, even if person X, who is 19 years or 20 years old, is next on the list, if there's one house or two houses that are available and there's two ladies who are 90 years or up to 100 years old, certainly those people, even if they're back in the queue, the government has directed that we have to give dignity to those people. They are almost in the twilight of their life. Certainly it gives them hope if they're given houses while they're still alive, as opposed to prioritizing a younger person who can still wait a bit longer compared to the person who is very old. And we also make exceptions to people who are very sick, terminally ill people, or child-headed households. It is for good reasons that such people should be prioritized, Chairperson, that who have got nowhere to go. I think it's in line with the policy of this government to prioritize such. But in the overall, we do not discriminate or unfairly disenfranchise a person who is on a waiting list. So definitely they get their chance. I thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Mr. Chauke. Do you still want to proceed? Okay. maybe before that, let me take the question from Honorable Maluleke.
Thank you, Chair. I was, in terms of what the, I don't know, the DG was saying on the criteria used in housing, it is difficult because some people who are poor, they can't have houses because the criteria that they use is focused only on the payments and everything. But people with big houses, they occupy RDP houses in the same yard with those big houses and RDP, and they use it for tools and everything. So the criteria is not managing for poor, because those who will be on the last of the list. But the ones who have the big houses, they will have those houses. The challenge is that you don't know that they have houses, the big houses, but the RDP will be building a big house. So that one is also maybe making people not to have houses. And the other one is that a person who is a man having children, maybe 18 years above, he doesn't qualify for a house because they said 18 years children must apply for themselves. And if he has to maybe to take my child, if it's my uncle, the one who's under 18, to apply for a house. When I want to apply for a house, the child is already applied with somebody. So it's also challenging on that part.
Yeah, Honorable Nyakembe.
You see, I like my colleagues because whenever they raise points, they make me to remember other things. I think the on the issue of the criteria now to human settlement around housing in particular, where you'll find a situation where I'm in the list, my child is up 18 and above, as she has indicated. If I passed on, then my child cannot take the place where I was in the list. They have to reapply. So I'm saying, in the policy, that's one area that I think human settlement need to look at. What do you do in a family? Yes, I have dependents, I've applied for an RDP house, but I passed away whilst I'm still in the waiting list. And then my kids now, they are going to suffer because they are 18 or above 18 years. Then they have to apply for themselves. So I think in looking at the policy, I think that becomes very critical.
Okay. Yeah. Dr. Mapisana, and you can take all other responses as well.
I think I just felt by the time the Honorable were asking about the recommendation that we should, as an office, apologize to on behalf of our commissioners as well, to say there was an oversight of including recommendations on the slide. On the report, they are included. They are on page 58. And per principle, in terms of each of the principles that we had assessed. But I think from the office, there was an oversight to include them on the slides that were presented. And I think on that, we apologize.
Actually, I noticed that. We'll come back to you, Mr. Chauke, on this matter, if you want to respond to it. Can I proceed to Van der Merwe? Yes.
Thanks, Chairperson. To start with the last issue that we discussed around the table, namely the issue of fairness, and then also the recommendations of the Public Service Commission. We would not, or our recommendations doesn't say how the department must change this process in order to make it more fair or to change the criteria. And examples was raised around the table. So our recommendation would simply be, it seems that there is, that this process is perceived as unfair in many cases. The department should analyze the whole process against the criteria of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act and put steps in place to make it more fair. So our recommendation would actually reflect our indicator. Our indicator is compliance with the Administrative Justice Act, and we will say, analyze your process against the, our recommendation would be, analyze your process against the requirements of the Administrative Justice Act. In this case, our recommendation even go a step further in the sense that the National Department has put decision-making steps, processes, and criteria in place. So our critique was not so much those processes and criteria, but how those are supervised by the provincial departments towards the municipalities, because the decision is actually taken on the municipal level. The provincial department doesn't take the decision. So our criticism was more on the supervision of this process. But I'm just saying our recommendation would not offer a detailed solution around how these criteria or processes should be changed. Our recommendation is simply apply the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. And we will go further and say there's a guideline available, and then we will refer them to the guideline issued by the National Department of Justice. It is the same, similar as the example that Commissioner Alepi has raised. Our recommendation around the slow recruitment processes, for instance, will simply be you should review your processes. But then in this case, we will refer them to a guideline, in this case a guideline issued by the Public Service Commission.
Thanks, Mr. Fanalmeza. Mr. Chauke.
Chairperson, thank you. I think we received the other questions from the other Honorable Mohalu, which was a follow-up question. I think her comment is very fair. There are instances where a person who may have been approved, say for example 2 years ago, and their house is only built now, you find that maybe in the same yard as it is built now, you find maybe the son who was at school at the time has just graduated and has now built maybe another house in the same yard, especially in Makai. So you do have such peculiar situations, and often when we're doing monitoring, we immediately those type of things, when we see a house that is government subsidized next to another house that is also built in that home, we ask questions on those, and then we find that where we suspect that there could be potential fraud, it happens in some cases, but in most cases you find that as it is explained by community leaders and councillors, find that at the time when the family applied, Ugogo was staying was the only breadwinner, and she qualified for that. But the house was not built immediately; it took maybe 4 or 5 years later. And you find that one of the children has come out from college, and with their little self, they're able to build blocks of bricks in the yard and build the house. So when the contractor finally comes 5 years later, it is difficult to say they must pass that yard because the son or the grandchild has just built a house. But Ugogo is the one who owns that yard, and she was approved almost 5 years ago. So those are some of the things that lead to this. But we pick them up through house-to-house M&E process when we go into those houses. But we will investigate other aspects that are related to possible fraud. I think the other question was around the disease. I think, Honorable, it's a very profound policy issue that says normally the policy provides for if a parent dies, it provides for inheritance. So we assist the children to inherit the property. But in the event that a parent dies before the house is allocated, I think it's a very valid policy question that I'll take it back to the department so that we find ways of, as you're suggesting, fast-tracking the children or back to the place where you were in the waiting list. I think it's a very valid concern.
Okay. Thanks. Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, I would request that you proceed to the last report. I'll just offer a 5 minute break for leg stretching, and then we sit down quickly. Because of time, it can be too long. Let's have five or at least six. Thank you.
Could I get your name, please?
Yes.
Thank you. I hope if everyone is settled, can we just call those who are outside so that we proceed and finalize. In the meantime, let's get the Public Service Commission putting the slide and getting ready for the very last presentation, because this other one, we're deferring it. That we're all back, can we request Commissioner Mtembo that we proceed with the last presentation?
Thank you, Chairperson and honorable members of the Portfolio Committee. We need to point out that in 2004, Cabinet took a decision that Public Service Commission should manage the National Anti-Corruption Hotline. So, which means that we have been given that responsibility since 2004. And in terms of the National Anti-Corruption Hotline, you know, members of the public can, you know, report, you know, anonymously. Or at times they can indicate who they are, cases of fraud, corruption-related issues. And then now we will take it up with investigation or refer them to the relevant departments for further handling. which means that since 2004 up to and including presently, we are managing that system. We need also to point out that now, with the current administration, one of its priorities is the question of the intensification of the fight against crime and corruption. And in the context of that, we took a decision in 2010 that we are going to conduct a study with an overall objective of assessing the most common manifestation of corruption and its related risks. We think we do have, relatively speaking, sufficient information to do that. In short, we hope with this report that we'll be able to give the committee the anatomy of corruption in the public service. What are the most common features, and how does that pose a risk in the public service? And we are confident that at the end of this presentation, you'll have a picture of this anatomy. And then not only that, but we're also making some recommendations to be that can be followed up with a view to make some improvement so that we're able to reduce the sketch of corruption in the public service. For now, I will therefore request Doctor, to make a presentation on this very last presentation. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committee, Commissioners and colleagues. As is indicated, is the presentation on the profiling and analysis of the most common manifestations of corruption and its related risks in the public service. And this is the outline of the presentation. We'll give you introduction. We'll also give you objectives of National Anti-Corruption Hotline, cases of alleged corruption reported to the NEC or National Anti-Corruption Hotline as at 31st June 2010, and the most common manifestations of corruption, and then we'll give findings, recommendations, and then we'll conclude. The global discourse on good governance is underpinned by the expectation that government should be proactive in fighting the spread of corruption and in promoting an integrity-driven form of administration. Accompanying such an integrity-driven administration should be the political will to put in place enabling policies and their commitment to implement them. And as the Commissioner indicated, since 2003, the Cabinet approved the establishment of one national anti-corruption hotline for the public service, and the PSC was mandated to manage such a hotline. And the PSC has seen the ideal institution, was seen as an ideal institution for hosting the National Anti-Corruption Hotline, given its independence and its oversight responsibilities for the public service. The objective of National Anti-Corruption Hotline are the following: to deter potential corruption by making all employees and members of the public aware that the public service is not a soft target. Detect incidents of corruption through encouraging whistleblowers to report incidents which they witness occurring in the public service. To ensure the successful investigation of alleged corruption and to provide feedback to whistleblowers. To raise awareness that government takes corruption seriously and to enable callers to report corruption anonymously, thus encouraging whistleblowing. Cases of alleged corruption reported to the National Anti-Corruption Hotline as at 31st June 2010, the analysis established that there is a slow rate of feedback with respect to cases being investigated. Those are the cases that would have been referred to the department. Of the 7,766 cases reported through the National Anti-Corruption and referred to departments since September 2004 to June 31st, 2010, feedback was received only 2,811 cases. That means 86% of them. This basically means that feedback on 4,965 cases, 63% of such cases referred to departments and public bodies by the PSC, is still outstanding. The largest number of cases of alleged corruption referred to and investigated by the department is on fraud and bribery, and those are 1,511 cases. And the mismanagement of government funds, those are 985 cases. The following figure will show the five categories of the most common manifestations of corruption as reported on the hotline. There you'll see that 1,511, which is fraud and bribery, followed by mismanagement of government funds, abuse of government resources, theft or corrupt activities around the ID or identity document, and procurement irregularities, forming 720 cases. Key findings by the Public Service Commission in terms of this study, 50% of the departments assessed have clearly written objectives on fighting corruption. However, the PSC found that departments tend to place little emphasis on investigating allegations of corruption. The study found that the contents of fraud and prevention plans tend to differ from one department to another, and that the implementation of these plans is inadequate. This is despite the fact that the PFMA outlines which fraud prevention plans should be put in place in the public service. There is some level of central control, providing a degree of consistency across policies, but with a greater degree of provincial variation and autonomy as compared to a centralized structure. In this regard, it was found that national or provincial departments and public entities are more likely to have their own policies for combating and preventing corruption. For example, here, the National Department of Health may have its own policy, and the provincial departments of health may also have their own policy, which is tailored to respond to the risks they face on a regular basis at their respective areas. And 50% of respondents indicated that their staffing within the anti-corruption units contributes to the capacity constraints experienced by departments regarding investigations. On average, the number of officials employed by the departments per anti-corruption unit is 4. And the units are generally led by middle managers, and I think middle managers will be mainly deputy directors or assistant directors in this regard. In some government departments, it was found that departments utilize consultants to address their capacity needs with regard to investigation and corruption-related matters. The utilization of consultants can be expensive and unsustainable. When it comes to assessing risk relating to fraud, 45% of respondents indicated that there is inadequate practical knowledge of assessing and managing the risk of fraud and corruption in the public service. And I think that has to do with the officials that might be involved in those units in terms of their capacity and understanding of the role that they have to play. Fraud awareness and training. The study found that fraud awareness training does get prioritized, with as much as 95% of sampled entities confirming that officials attend anti-corruption awareness campaigns during the induction courses and during ad hoc campaigns. With the application of discretion, the PSC found that the areas of utmost concern to departments are those where officials have to use their discretion whether to investigate cases of alleged corruption. Departments tend to request the closure of a case even if the case has not been investigated. This has resulted in queries from whistleblowers who are concerned about the cases of alleged corruption not being investigated and lack of feedback in such instances. Disciplinary sanctions. The PSC found that departments are too lenient in imposing disciplinary sanctions against corrupt officials found guilty of fraud and corruption, e.g., for example, a written or final written warning is taken against officials who are found guilty of misconduct, or no action is taken against such officials. Moreover, the PSC found that departments do not refer cases of alleged corruption to South African Police Service for criminal prosecution where it is necessary. This is a serious concern as it undermines the fight against corruption in the public service. When it comes to suspension, this is another interesting aspect, because departments take more than 60 days to finalize disciplinary inquiries, even in minor offenses. And I think the 60 days is the one that is stipulated, that departments within days, once cases have been referred to them, they must investigate, but then they take by far more than that. This is too costly for government, as the officials are being suspended from duty, and in many instances with full pay. Officials are being suspended in some instances for more than a year or even more than two. The employer must hold a disciplinary hearing within a month or 60 days, depending on the complexity of the matter and the length of the investigation. And I think we generated the following recommendations in as far as this report is concerned. Addressing fraud and bribery. Departments should periodically conduct surprise procurement audits of selected projects to identify weaknesses and malpractices in procurement processes. The risk management plans and fraud prevention plans of departments must further be updated to address such risks. And I think this surprise audits, we have the view that they will help to identify a situation where officials might be relaxed in certain procurement requirements. Conducting risk management, the PSC recommends that each accounting officer must specifically focus on and analyze corruption risk as part of the risk management required in terms of the PFMA and implement fraud prevention plans required in terms of the PFMA. And then I think our view is that accounting officers, in many instances, they are a bit lenient and that they don't get hands-on when it comes to dealing with matters of corruption, and particularly with risk management. Disciplinary actions against public officials. The PSC recommends that departments report all fraud and corruption-related activities to the SAPS in order for criminal action to be taken against perpetrators. This is even against the stipulated clause that talks about where more than 100 million is involved. But we're saying in every activity, because corruption is corruption, whether it's a toilet paper or a pen. Suspensions. The PSC recommends that heads of departments must be held accountable and responsible if they do not ensure that a disciplinary inquiry is resolved within 60 days, depending on the complexity of the matter and the length of the investigations thereof. Enhancing effective capability in the public service. We are of the view that there should be centralized anti-corruption investigation units, particularly at provincial level, and such units can be located at the offices of the premiers, because then there will be such coordination that can be enforced. And such units should be capacitated, because we are of the view that if they are not capacitated and are not understanding the dynamics and the nature of corruption and the process that must be followed in terms of investigations, then having such a unit must still be a fruitless exercise. So there should be effort that should be made to ensure that such units and the resources available are put in that regard. Coordinate and investigate investigative capacities in the local sphere of government. And I think in terms of local government or local sphere of government, such activities as well should be coordinated, especially in the offices of the mayors or executive mayors, because they reside with such power. Departments and public entities must conduct an in-depth assessment of their fraud risk management frameworks and strategies, and the outcome of such assessments could prevent an overinvestment in suboptimal and anti-fraud areas. And I think we're saying once you have done such an assessment, you are likely to know the depth and the magnitude of corruption in your respective departments. That a guideline on minimum sanctions for specific offenses of fraud and corruption must be issued by the Minister for Public Service Administration. The guideline should make provisions for minimum sentences to be imposed by departments in acts of misconduct. And this way we'll be able to avoid the discretion where departments seem to perform or impose sanctions as they wish or as and when. That once a case of alleged corruption or fraud is detected, departments must conduct an internal disciplinary hearing concurrently with the referral of the case to the South African Police Service for criminal charges. In conclusion, we're saying with this information that is now in public domain and that body of knowledge that is in available, more could be done in combating and preventing corruption if strategies, structures, and anti-corruption capabilities are well coordinated in the public service. And government must commit as much resources as possible to address capacity constraints in relation to the investigation of cases of alleged corruption. And that way, we can win this battle against corruption. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Members.
That was the report. Can I take hands that are ready to for clarification, questions, and engagement on the report? Again, Honourable Williams, you're first.
Thank you, Chairperson. It was reported that 63% of reported cases are still outstanding. I'd like to know, how does this, the Special Anti-Corruption Unit fit into this? And can these 4,955 cases be referred to them so that we can get some clarity on this? Because I don't know how far this Anti-Corruption Unit has it got powers to just cut across departments. We need some more clarity on this. The other question is, has the PSC looked at the capacity of departments to actually charge and discipline corrupt officials? In other words, then, like at local government level, municipalities often outsource their HR function, in particular when it comes to disciplinary hearings, to lawyers and attorneys, and this obviously is costly. And what is the capacity of the departments to actually run these disciplinary hearings? And wouldn't it be more suitable to, for instance, departments to create special anti-corruption disciplinary people with skills along this particular charge? Because it's very difficult to actually convict an employee and have them fired. I'm a former shop steward, and it was my job to keep that person employed. So in other words, then, what I would go for would be a suspended dismissal or something along those lines, and that's what unions will go for. Now, Howard will definitely go for that. So I'm just trying to establish whether or not departments have the capacity to do that, to actually find the corrupt and to remove them. Because if they haven't got that capacity, they will outsource, and those lawyers will obviously want the case to continue and blah, blah, blah. It's very expensive. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Williams. Honourable Suka.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't want to follow the step of the shop steward, but sorry, Chairperson. I just want to check whether is there no time frame for a case of corruption or any nature where it loses its status and the case is closed. At what stage? Because sometimes a person might be suspended for ages and donkeys up to a point that even those who are laying a charge pass on or pass away, you know, or died, and then the case is closed. Is there no way of speeding up this matter? But secondly, you see, what also causes a case to be protracted from a provincial point of view, you'll find that in some provinces they have what you call a legal shed services. And that legal shed services is so incapacitated in terms of warm bodies, finding only two or one person who must handle the plethora of challenges or cases, and he's all by himself or herself. So I think that's one weakness in terms of the capacity. Sometimes the departments would want to move on with speed and agility, but because there's only one shared legal service, everything goes to the premier's office. That's where all normally it resides. Haven't you looked into that so that you overcome this problem? And the last matter, Chairperson, look, the PFMA gives responsibility to the accounting officer. And in this case, the accounting officer is the AG. The accounting officer. Now, here you are talking about the minister, who must, sanction some guidelines in dealing with matters of this fraud or corruption, whatever. Is there no conflict or direct conflict between the PFMA and the power as an accounting officer vested to him or her vis-à-vis the minister or the ministry in relation to your guidelines? Or surely who is in the den when these two are having these powers? I know of the devolution of powers to the accounting officers, but surely the PFMA does speak to this, but also the minister come to play on the matter. I just want to get some more clarity on what I'm raising. I'm sure you do understand what I'm trying to say. I might not be a legal person.
I don't know if the department wants to come first before we hand over to the Public Service Commission.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, and thank you to the honourable members. Let me start firstly with the issue around the Special Anti-Corruption Unit. I think we need to accept the Special Anti-Corruption Unit will not have sufficient capacity to deal with all disciplinary cases across the public service. The intention in terms of the Special Anti-Corruption Unit is to deal with high-profile cases and to provide support, guidance, training to capacitate the departments to deal with their own cases. So we're looking at that process. Just to indicate the Special Anti-Corruption Unit has established a very close working relationship with the Special Investigative Unit to give us prosecutorial support in handling these cases. They have the capacity and the skills. And they will also support us in the training and development of HR practitioners, labor relations practitioners across the government. So what the second part of the question deals with what would be the powers of the Special Anti-Corruption Unit. At this stage, we need to be very clear. The Special Anti-Corruption Unit that we established has absolutely no powers to take over a case that is in a department. The responsibility for dealing with discipline rests with the accounting officer, the head of department and the MEC or executing authority in the department. So all of the cases we're going to take on will be on a mutual basis. In other words, both parties agree that we will be acting on behalf of a department at the end of the day, appointed by the head of department to manage those cases. Having said all of that, I think we're all aware that the minister is very clear that we want to establish the Special Anti-Corruption Unit as a government component, as a standalone government component. And when we go that route, we will then define its powers through a regulation at that point, which may address some of the concerns. The issue around outsourced HR is an area we've picked up. We're very mindful of that, and the resultant delays in cases as a result of the involvement of lawyers. And we are running a number of training programs from DPSA together with Palama to support the training and the capacitation of labor relations practitioners from our side. And we agree, you need special skills to deal with some of these cases. Some of these corruption cases are very, very complex, and therefore the support of SIU is very welcome in managing a number of those cases. The next question deals with the time frame and the lapsing of cases. I mean, can they be closed or not? It's a very interesting question. At the moment, in terms of a disciplinary case, there's no time frame. There is a time frame in relation to suspension. If an individual is suspended with full pay, that case must be finalized within 60 days. 30 days preferably, but extended for the 60 days. The normal thing that happens at the end of the 60 days, the individual returns to work, but the case is not finalized. And that's an issue we're very mindful of. But to be honest as well, there's been a number of cases that have been dealt with, and some people have been on in terms of the disciplinary process, 3-4 years down the line. At the end of the day, we lose many of those cases when they go to arbitration for the simple reason that justice delayed is justice denied, so the individual gets away with it. So we're mindful of some of those difficulties. There's prescriptions as well that come into some of these things. The DPSA has gone through a lengthy exercise, part of Outcome 12 and the work that we're trying to do in terms of improving efficiency and effectiveness in human resource management in the public service. We've come up with a uniform sanctioning guideline to assist departments in managing, to ensure that there's consistency in the way we sanction people found guilty of corruption-related crimes as well as other aspects within misconduct. That guideline is currently being consulted within government departments, and we will be taking it to the executive for approval very, very soon. We've also developed a guideline on suspensions, on how to deal with suspensions and to finalize them within the 60-day period. That's also been consulted. Madam Speaker, the final question dealt with the issue around the powers of the executing authorities and accounting officers versus the powers of the MPSA. The powers of the Minister for Public Service and Administration is clearly defined in the Public Service Act, which says the Minister is responsible for establishing national norms and standards on all of those areas, including national norms and standards in relation to labor relations, in relation to misconduct, in relation to any of that. So the Minister can issue, either through a directive or through regulations, national norms and standards on all of these things, determining time frames or determining any other aspect. But what we've chosen to do at this stage is to issue guidelines to support a number of these things. But the ultimate responsibility in the finalization of any case of misconduct rests with the executing authority and the accounting officers. Thanks, Minister.
Thanks,
Commander.
You want to... Yeah, just go. Public Service Commission, yes. Commissioner.
Yeah. Thanks, Chairperson. On the issue by Honorable Williams on whether we have looked at the capacity of departments, we have done that on two reports. We have even advised departments to follow what the DPSA calls minimum requirements for dealing with anti-corruption. We have done that and introduced that to them. But you see, I think we may have as many systems and processes as possible, but if we don't have the will, you know, to do that, I think that has been the main problem. I mean, in various provinces, for example, anti-corruption units, anti-corruption summits have been held, you know, and that is where most of them are standing now. But at the same time, there are areas of good practice, for example, in some municipalities, where people have literally been arrested and money has been recovered. In Mangaung, for example, in the Free State, the anti-corruption unit there is working, I mean, quite well. There are amounts that have been discovered or reclaimed from officials, and those officials are going to court and others have been fired. And that, to me, says, you know, this can work. There are people still willing to do it. You know, and perhaps we should learn from those practices. And so for me, then that issue has to be dealt with at least at the level where there's also political will to make it work.
Okay. Thanks, Commissioner. Are you also making, Commissioner
Mangwash? Yeah. Chair, I think perhaps to take the matter further, when the committee engages with the cluster, one of the things to look at is witness protection of whistleblowers, because often that limited anti-corruption capacity is eroded when firstly people, you know, people who investigate cases get harassed often. There are cases where people have come to us and say, I'm in a department and I'm investigating a case and I'm, you know, people are suspended and so on and so forth. Perhaps I'm saying maybe we need to look at going beyond just protecting whistleblowers and look into that area of work. There's very little capacity, and that capacity will be eroded if people cannot do that work without being intimidated.
So, thanks. Is there any other issue from the Public Service Commission?
Thanks, Honorable Chairman. Perhaps just to wrap up from this side, I think in terms of some of these cases that take long, two things. I think in many instances we do find that there are officials who, when they are aware that they have committed a particular corrupt activity in a particular department, they are about to be charged, or the process hasn't been finalized, they move to another department. And therefore, it will be very difficult for a previous department to even follow up on such instances. So I think it's a bit tricky as well. But I think on the issue of even the whistleblowers, one challenge that we continue to face is that because most of the public members of the public, when they report, they remain anonymous, and for obvious reasons, because they don't want to be harassed and so on by those that they might be investigating, there will be no details about them. So it is very difficult when we manage this anti-corruption hotline to follow up when necessary. So so that we can get more details about whatever they've experienced and so on. Because when we refer these cases to respective departments, chances are that departments will say, we don't know, or we investigated, but there's no information that is corroborating that. People are refusing, or they're saying it's not me, and so on and so forth. But you can't go back to the person who reported to say, by the way, what else did you see, and so on. So that makes it very, very difficult for some of those departments to investigate, or even for PSC to follow up and so in those departments to make sure that they are finalized. So it becomes very, very tricky indeed. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Mampiswan. Okay, I think we have covered the latter part of issues that we wanted to really focus on as the committee and everyone who participated. I don't know if maybe there's a last word from the commissioners that they want to say, but we really want to appreciate that we had actually given you pressure to put a lot of reports at a go. And I think the flow of how the reports were done, you actually put a lot of work in there to appreciate that. Just to emphasize from our side that that the trend we're going to take moving forward is that when reports are presented, we're definitely going to have also department's consent so that we're able to actually deal with all those matters. While we're there, you can clarify what you meant about this, the actual response. If there are matters that we pick up as the committee, we'll definitely line up a follow-up in terms of how do we do it. But it will be good that, you know, once the report are put, there are some discussions immediately rather than later. And I must indicate that we know that even the Public Service Commission is operating, you know, under stress because there's no much, there's a lot of members that still have to be beefed up. Many commissioners. A task that this committee has to actually engage and finalize, and my opinion is that the committee has done so well in terms of pushing that matter quite quickly, and very soon will be, you know, after the president can be able, you know, because it ends up with the president, after the president has actually approved whatever is on our way, the commission will be fully fledged. And I must indicate, even the House itself, we will be presenting a report to the House tomorrow as an indication that was given. It could have been presented yesterday, but it was withdrawn based on a pressure of what Parliament had tabled. And therefore, they just indicated that because of a lot of work and the time that is already long, it's a matter that's going to be presented on Thursday, and therefore we know that by Thursday the matter will have been offloaded from our side as the committee into the in Parliament would have done justice to it, and it will be left with the President, and I know it won't take too long. I must indicate that like we did indicate in the past, the Auditor General and the Public Service Commission are very critical to this committee, and we're going to continuously work with yourselves in terms of doing our appropriate oversight, and therefore expect a lot of calls of this nature, and therefore we will definitely utilize yourself, you know, in collaboration for our work. I'll just leave it to the commissioners if there's anything they need to comment on, and before we close the meeting.
Thank you, Chairperson, as well as members of the Portfolio Committee. Perhaps there's one question which was not responded to, raised by the Honourable Williams. He wanted clarity on the question of the 63% of cases which is still outstanding since the inception of the hotline. Yes. That is a concern that we're having. Probably the challenge around this is with the current model or the framework. Because with this model, what happens is this, that now, once cases are reported to the hotline, now we have to send them to those departments which are the culprits. And more often than not, if it's the head of department or a chief director who's very influential, how do you expect those departments to investigate themselves? So that's a challenge. On the other hand, if now we were to take the responsibility of investigating, it means we have to take all our resources to do that. The 100 something million will have to deal with those, imagine the 700 something thousand of cases. it's not even going to be enough. So now the current model is this, that now we use what you say, a cherry pick. That's the same approach that is used by the DPSA. Those high profile where if it's an HOD, we know there will be no investigation, then we zoom in. Or if we are convinced that there's no way that this department is going to investigate itself. So now those are the challenges which we were grappling with, which means that now what we have proposed, that we need to capacitate the department itself. That seems to be one route to deal with this challenge, which we have correctly identified that it needs to be head on. Further than that, Chairperson, we are very happy that we're able to interact with you. I'm having a sense that this kind of an interaction and the commitment that the is made by the Chairperson to work with us, to interact with us, just like the Auditor General, is well appreciated. One of the biggest challenges which we're having as a Public Service Commission is the fact that now we churn out reports and make recommendations that are gathering dust. And if now we are having a committee that's making explicitly clear that we need a more vigorous and robust, you know, interaction and ensure that these recommendations are actually being implemented, I think we'll go a long way in promoting the vision which is outlined in the Constitution of the kind of a public service administration South Africa is envisaged in the Constitution. I think your committee and the Public Service Commission, as well as the Auditor General, we can go a long way in moving towards the attainment of that vision in our Constitution. Lastly, we want also to appreciate the fact that your committee chairperson has worked very hard to fill those vacant posts. We are really grossly, understaffed. Not only head office, even in other provinces. We appreciate the fact that now you have taken this process very, very fast. And we're also happy that, in fact, this report should have been debated yesterday, but it is quite, you know, heartening, the fact that it's going to be debated today, and we look forward to the filling of those votes so that we'll have a complete complement, so that we'll be able to do our work as it's expected of us by the Constitution. With those words, I want to thank you very much. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Commissioner Mthembu, maybe in conclusion, to just indicate that it's also this committee's concern that your budget had been collapsed into the department. We do guard jealously into your independence, and we are working hard in terms of making sure that your independence remains independent in a real sense of being independent, and therefore it has been a responsibility as well of this committee to ensure that that matter has been corrected. And as I'm talking to yourselves, you might be knowing and have interacted with, there has been an establishment of the institutions, of the Office of the Institution Supporting Democracy in the Deputy Speaker's office. And it is doing an overall interaction with the independent institutions. And now there's a big discussion of the Chapter 9 and 10 institutions. And therefore, we want to believe that it will put the corrective wherever they need to be done. But as a matter of fact, it's one major issue as well. It's not just left in the periphery, but there is robust engagement on these matters. And I would like to thank you all. And now we can adjourn the agenda committee. Thank you.